Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Clayton Eshelman, American poet. I was very satisfied to receive in the mail several weeks ago a new big book from Clayton Eshelman published by the Wesleyan University Press. It's called Juniper Fuse. Its subtitle is Upper Paleolithic Imagination and the Construction of the Underworld. Clayton Eshelman is the author of around 12 collections of poetry, which, as they appeared, were large, most of them published by Black Sparrow. Now his work, Translations and Poetry, is being published by the Wesleyan University Press, and much of his history can be discovered by the person who uses the web at www.claytoneshelman.com. Now, I first encountered Clayton Eshelman as a translator of Cesar Vallejo, a magnificent poet in Spanish, and later some of his translations, truly harrowing, of Artaud. I've heard him read in public many times, and this book, Juniper Fuse, is the culmination of some 30 years of work, working on poetry, essays, projective mythologies inspired by the illustrated caves, the engraved caves in the Dordogne, in Lascaux. And this book kind of astonished me. The only thing I know of quite like it, and it's not very close, is I was once given a notebook published of the history of a poem by Ponge, the French poet. He'd written a poem called The Meadow, and subsequently there was a book published many times its size that described his researches, his processes in writing, earlier drafts, little plays and dialogues he invented. Juniper Fuse includes some of the poems that Eshelman has written over the past 30 years about the caves, but more specifically, it's a narrative of his changing awareness of how the caves function poetically, what their cultural resonance and meaning is. The book is profusely illustrated. It even has colored plates. And if, like me, you'd been told that Picasso visited the caves, hence a moment extraordinary in the women of Avignon, you've only known the beginning. This is the rearrival of the prehistoric into culture and an understanding that what we think of or have made to seem like the trip to hell, the trip to the underworld, is in fact, in Clayton's reading, a voyage of rebirth and a reacquaintance with the earth. When was it that you first saw the caves, Clayton?
The translator, Helen Lane, came to Paris when Carol, my wife, and I were living there in 1973 and told us that before we left France, we had to see the Dordogne. And she made such a commanding case for a visit to the Dordogne that we rented sight unseen an apartment in a farm complex outside of Les Aisies de Taillac, which at that point had signs at the town's limit calling itself the capital of prehistory. Those signs are down now. So there we went. We bought a secondhand car, and we went down to our apartment. And after we got there, we met Hal Movius' secretary, who was living in the same place. And Hal Movius was a Harvard archaeologist who'd been excavating a dig, the Abri Pateau, in Les Aisies for many years. And he was important, and he got us into Lascaux. When I saw Lascaux, I was completely knocked out. And I thought, wow, What can I do with this? So I started talking with Helen about who had written what, and she gave me all of the books that she had, and I discovered that no creative writer, certainly no poet, had taken on the Upper Paleolithic and done what Charles Olson referred to as a saturation job. So I started sort of willy-nilly to mount this investigation, in which we returned as often as we could, and I started making contact with French archaeologists because, as you may know, why only a few of the caves are open to the public. There's around 160 caves in France with Upper Paleolithic decorations, and I'd say about 15 can be visited by people.
Well, as I understand it, we are ourselves injurious. Our presence is injurious to the caves. What we bring in with us, our oxygen, the pollen we carry from outside, rots the cave?
Well, the cave that has had the most problems is Lascaux, and Lascaux was mishandled terribly. They were allowing up to 2,000 people a day into Lascaux, which doubled the temperature of the cave and created various kinds of microbial and algae formations in the paintings. So Lascaux was closed in 1963, and they more or less invented the science of cave preservation.
Now, it's my impression, you mentioned before Charles Olson and his recommendation that in order to master a subject poetically, one do a saturation job. There was gloriously the tradition of the poem project. To some extent, William Carlos Williams, Patterson, is a representative. When Charles Olson writes Call Me Ishmael, he's doing his saturation job on Herman Melville. When Ezra Pound writes about the poetics of the troubadours, he's attempting to reintroduce to a culture something it has lost to its disservice, to its sadness. And so what, in writing about the caves and the drawings in the caves, are you reintroducing?
Well, I'm attempting to engage the images on, let's say, two levels. I find that there's a lot of observational material in them, and I also find that there's a lot of fantasy material in them, and that these often become an inseparable mix. So as a poet, I decided to do my homework on an observational basis, to visit and revisit and to read everything that the archaeologists have written, and at the same time to allow myself to fantasize and to make use of my own imagination when I look at these images, when I ponder them in my workroom, and try to engage them on these two levels rather than engaging them simply as the archaeologists have on an observational level.
Now, one of the things that's always impressed me about these poems as they emerged, I think beginning in Coils, is that correct?
No, Coils was finished right before we went to the caves. The first stuff that was really, very sound appears in Hades and Manganese in 1981. There's a few poems before that, but they're pieces that I don't consider important any longer.
What struck me as they emerged, yes, they enter immediately the tradition of the difficult poem promulgated by research, but they seem to know from the very start that they are interested in bringing the body into the rigors and difficulties of the procedures, so that what you're hearing is a kind of mind-body construct in which the body is expressive of the soul and vice versa, and we're entering a realm where we're being told that if the language should become mystical or hypnotic even, that what we are experiencing is a merging of knowledge and erotics that is meant to be slightly beyond immediate comprehension.
Yes, yes. I certainly try to communicate and I work with my wife as an editor who reads everything that I'm writing, and she's involved in what we might call its middle passage. I start things and I end things. At the same time that I'm also writing to myself, as I think most serious poets do. So I'm exploring things that I'm thinking about, and on one hand, I'm trying to remain open to a kind of a critical awareness of what I'm writing. At the same time, I'm also writing in a kind of a trance. In other words, I find the ideal state to work in is a kind of dreaming awake, in which the subconscious is inducted and is part of the process. I mean, I think that really that's the subconscious is the ground for poetry and poetics, as it is for shamanism, which I think is part of the world of the caves. I don't think that one can say that all of these images were made by shamans in a trance, but I think that there's around 30 images, most of which I deal with in Juniper Fuse, that can be read as a kind of proto-shamanism. And the shaman, as I understand it, was the sort of the first mental traveler, to make use of that Blake title. And I think mental travel is poetics, so that I think that the roots of poetry are present in metaphors that go back to 30,000 years ago.
I remember when I heard you reading that poem, I remember when I heard you reading Visions of the Fathers of Lascaux. I had commented to you when you came to the last line, which is now wintered in the stall of our invaginated perdition, that was really quite a line, and that in a certain way, poems, to my mind, weren't being written in memorable lines like that. What strikes me about the phrase, our invaginated perdition, is that it really encapsulates many of the themes of the poem that it ends. Hmm. It has been comparing the process of visiting hell, perdition, to a different process, the return to the womb, mm-hmm. invaginated perdition. And it's been making a distinction between those two processes. In fact, claiming, I think, that one of the diseases of the century has been to make our Dachaus versions of these caves, when in fact they represent really a prelapsarian inclination toward paradise.
Yes.
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 And that it has been the curse of a century to lose the prehistorical vision of a woman, a womb culture, mm-hmm. to a hell culture. Mm-hmm. Could you speak mm-hmm. about that?
Well, I think one of the distinctions that's important here to make is to make the distinction between the underworld and hell. I mean, the hell is a Christianized sort of reduction of the world of the underworld. And when it may be the fastest way to get to that for many of your listeners would be to evoke the Odyssey, where Odysseus goes down into the underworld to have a conversation with Tiresias and get information on how he can get home. So from the Greek sense then, which is quite, you know, next door to us today, it's not that old, the underworld was a place that you went to learn, and not a place of torture, not a place of damnation, of, you know, eternal torment, et cetera, et cetera. So I think of the caves as the first alternative universe. I think of the caves as the first vision of paradise, of the first place in which people could sort of lose themselves in a kind of a sensory deprivational environment in which things happened in their heads that is very close to what we think of as alternative consciousness. So that I think of this is the place in which human beings, or Cro-Magnon people, our direct ancestors, began to work out what I would call the rudiments of imagination, and began to, on one hand, sense their separation from animals. They began to project, in a sense, in my sense of it, the animal out of their to-be human heads and to place it on the walls. And they began this incredible separation continuum that we now identify as culture versus wilderness. At the same time, I think there was a reactionary swerve of rebonding to the animal that they were losing. And I think the rebonding actually is the beginning of shamanism, in which the initial paradise was envisioned as something having been lost to be recaptured. And this perhaps can help us read the hybrids or the bison-headed figures, the bird-headed figures that are part human, part animal, that often appear in the plethora of animal forms in the caves.
One of the things that you suggest in your introduction is that the person entering the cave to render an animal. Now, this is occurring in time approximately when?
Well, the earliest known painting at this point is a black male rhinoceros in Chauvet that is radiocarbon dated at 32,400. The Upper Paleolithic more or less ends, as far as cave imagery goes, at around 10,000 years ago. So we're looking now at about a 22,000-year continuum.
And you suggest that this man, penetrating the darkness, having not spears or tools for penetration, is making a window, in a sense, that he's landing on a wall, that he's feeling the wall, that from the wall is emanating the feeling of the animal, perhaps beyond it, certainly outside of the cave.
Well, keep in mind that most of these people, we think, had hand lamps that gave very flickering and unsteady light, and that the cave walls themselves, under such lighting circumstances, often appear through their stalagmitic and stalactitic formations, draperies, etc., to show signs of animals. In other words, that you can see the rump of an animal in the wall as if that animal is emerging or withdrawing into the wall, so that, especially with the flickering lamp, it gives a very much more vivid, I would think, impression of that figure than we have with a steady beam.
Well, what I loved was the idea that, like the soul struggling to escape from Michelangelo's stone, that we are not painting on the walls, we're painting what the wall is showing us.
That's a nice way to put it.
Very great distinction, that we are not then imposing or decorating. We're educing from the wall what it seems to be presenting to us, lit only by candlelight, the wick from Juniper, the title of the book by my guest, Clayton Eshelman, Juniper Fuse. By the way, you're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. And what I'm thinking about is the sense in which the poet is going into the darkness, into the cave, to experience something perplexing and beyond. Jung would have it be the area of the shadow. At any rate, he goes to find something unknown. And this unknown thing is not to be too specifically resolved. Otherwise, it loses its saving values. So I find the book, Juniper Fuse, fascinating because on the one hand, we have texts that are texts of investigation and description that are, it seems, meant to bring things into light, juxtaposed with poetry, with photographs, and with drawings. And all of these things seem to me to create a mix that has something to say about knowing, or about not knowing, or about going beyond knowledge, that the book is, you know, in its mixture. of kinds of texts, an attempt to go beyond and say something about what poetry and art do that the rational mind may not excel at.
Yes, the mix of genres was referred to once by Northrop Frye as an anatomy, and that seems to me to be a fascinating word to talk about this book of multiple genres. What you're pushing towards there, I think, might, as a response from me, it might be best to read a page or two from the book at this point rather than try to describe the page or two, to try to keep it within the imaginal context. And what I'm going to look at is a section from Notes on a Visit to Le Duc d'Audebert that runs for about a page and a half, at which point I began to try to track what was going on in my head as I was moving with considerable difficulty through this cave in the Pyrenees. To be gripped by a womb of stone, to be in the grip of the surge of life, imprisoned in stone. It is enough to make one sweat one's animal. Having left the nuptial hall of white stone breasts in which one can amply stand, the breasts hang in clusters right over one's head, one must then squirm vertically up the spiral chimney, or use the current iron ladder, to enter the upper level via a cat hole into a corridor through which one must crawl on hands and knees. Then another longish cat hole through which one must crawl on one's belly, squirming through a human-sized tunnel, to a corridor through which one can walk haltingly, stooping, occasionally slithering through vertical cat slits and straddling short walls. If one were to film one's postures through this entire process, it might look like a St. Vitus dance of the stages in the life of man. Birth channel expulsion to old age, but without chronological order. A jumble of exaggerated and strained positions that correspondingly increase the image pressure in one's mind. While in Le Duc d'Audebert, I felt the broken horse rear in agony in the cave-like stage of Picasso's Guernica. At times I wanted to leave my feet behind or to continue headless in the dark. My stomach desired prawn-like legs with grippers. My organs were in the way. Something inside of me wanted to be an armored worm, one feeler extending out its head. I swear I sense the disintegration of the backbone of my mother, now buried 12 years. Entangled in a cat hole, I felt my tongue start to press backwards, and the image force was, I wanted to choke myself out of myself, to give birth to my own strangulation, and then nurse my strangulation at my own useless male breasts. Useless? No, for Le Duc d'Audebert unlocks memories that bear on a single face the expressions of both Judith and Holofernes at the moment of beheading. Mingled disgust, terror, delight, and awe. One is stimulated desire to enter cavities within oneself where dead men can be heard talking. In Le Duc d'Audebert, I heard something in me whisper me to believe in God, and something else in me whispered that the command was the rasp of a 6,000-year-old man who wished to be venerated again. And if what I'm saying here is vague, it is because both voices had to sound themselves in the bowels of this most personal and impersonal stone, in which sheets of myself felt themselves corrugated with nipples, as if the anatomy of life could be described from this perspective, as entwisted tubes of nippled stone, through which perpetual and mutual beheadings and birthings were taking place.
Clayton Eshelman reading from his book, Juniper Fuse. Now, as a contrast, I would like it if you would read the journal passage that appears on the page of the dedication. Because I wanted, well, I'll say what I wanted as soon as you've read it.
The book is dedicated to Carol, my wife. Lesbinas, 1974. We carried our dinner outside to the stone table on the landing by the door to our second-floor Buissou apartment. The farm was on a rise, which sloped down through an apple orchard. When we sat down to eat, well before sunset, we had for entertainment an extraordinary sky. Clouds would come floating over the woods, spreading out over us, puff collisions, Mickey Mouse ears, gargoyles shredding, turrets, veils, mammoth apparitions densifying and disintegrating as they appeared. Many reminded us of the images we were trying to discern on the cave walls. To sit at that stone table, what an experience! To be in love there, at one of the most vital times in our many years together. Much of what happened, the event aspects, during our first spring and summer in the Dordogne, is now as dispersed as the clouds we used to watch. Yet it billows in us, an inclusive cloud whose heart is ours.
Again, Clayton Eshelman reading a journal entry that appears on the dedication page of Juniper Fuse. Now, I want to notice, since these two passages can be put side by side, how wonderful it is for all of that stone to turn into clouds and to be shredded and dispersed, that somehow or other, part of the effect of this book is to watch a very constricting consciousness drift into clouds, and that this is the sign on the book's door, not abandon all hope, ye who enter here, but watch as what we went down into the bowels of the earth to find gets reflected in a sky of clouds going rapidly away and dispersing. There's a kind of beautiful levity, ultimately, that the book arrives at after a work of 30 years. It's as if what one does is gather in order to witness the dispersion.
Well, that's a wonderful way to put it. I like that.
I've been speaking to Clayton Eshelman about his book collection, Anatomy Phantasmagoria, Juniper Fuse, published recently by Wesleyan University Press. Clayton Eshelman's newest work has been being published by Wesleyan University Press, and his history as a poet and thinker, historian, student of poetics can be found at his website, www.claytoneshelman.com. Thank you very much for joining me here today, Clayton.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been a pleasure. You can read an excerpt from Juniper Fuse on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.